Genesis 10, the 11th talk in a series in Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on November 5, 2000, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2000. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed, in whole, for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking in Genesis chapter 10 today. This is one of the more exciting parts of Genesis, where we look at the genealogy of the descendants of Noah. Last time I talked about the flood, after the flood, God brought the flood as a judgment upon mankind at a time when all of mankind had turned against God, had become evil. And God says, in the text it says, every intent of the thoughts of man's heart was only evil. Man was thoroughly corrupted, and not only was man thoroughly corrupted, but every man was thoroughly corrupted. God decided to destroy all of mankind except for one righteous man, Noah, and his family. Now, after the flood, and this is what we talked about last time, after the flood, I argued that it appears as though God decided to take a different approach. It's like a new beginning after the flood. And in this new beginning, God is going to relate to man somewhat differently. Not entirely differently, but somewhat differently. And the difference is going to be that God is going to kind of step back. He is going to deal with man less directly and less overtly. And as a result of that, and what I took as my cue that is what part of the change that's happening, is after the flood, God says that any man who takes the life of a man, his life shall be taken by men. In other words, he is granting to mankind the authority to punish murderers, to punish outrageous wrongdoing. I got it. And essentially, that is the foundation of the state. As Max Weber said, quoting Trotsky approvingly, every state is founded on power. That ultimately it comes down to brute force. And God is authorizing man to punish outrageous wrongdoing. And by doing so, he is, in a sense, authorizing government. That doesn't mean that God looks with approval on everything that states do. But I think what he's saying is, I'm stepping back and I'm turning over some of the government of mankind to states. That's the way it's going to be. But man had not substantially changed as a result of the judgment of the flood, as we see in Ham. One who had seen this judgment carried out on, we don't know how many people, but Ham, having gotten off of the ark, commits an act of outrageous, at least, disrespect. Okay. So then mankind proliferates and spreads out, and the next chapter, chapter 10, tells us how people spread throughout the earth. Is this working? Okay. Okay. I'm not going to read through chapter 10 because it's mostly a lot of names. But there are a few things that are striking about it. One is that it underscores the unity of mankind. We are all descended from Noah. This is interesting because this is in contrast to the other genealogies of the ancient cultures, in which, for instance, the Egyptians believed that they had a different origin than the rest of mankind. And other lists of all the nations of ancient times are simply lists of nations conquered by other nations. But here we have a description of all of the peoples as they have spread out over the earth. There are a total in this list of 70 entries. 70 entries in Hebrew literature seems to mean completeness or wholeness. So it's indicating this unity of all of the people into one. The order in which the sons of Noah are listed, Japheth is first, Ham is second, and Shem third. That's typical in Genesis, that person which the narrative account is going to follow on comes last. In the names, we have some names of people. Sometimes it's names of a group of people, a nationality, and sometimes it's a name of a place. So it's all mixed up. It's not necessarily one or the other. Some of the names appear in two different genealogies, in Ham and Japheth, for instance, in both lines. There are two people who show up in two different places. It's possible that those are two people with the same name. It's possible that it indicates some kind of intermarriage, and it's possible that it's just a mixing of the peoples. Japheth, as it describes him, his descendants are essentially the Europeans and the Western Asians. It includes the Greeks, the Romans, the Germans, the Russians, so it's those peoples that we usually call the Indo-Europeans. The descendants of Ham, generally speaking, are those people that populated northern Africa, Ethiopia, Egypt, Libya, as well as the southern part of Arabia. The descendants of Shem are primarily those in the ancient Near East, the areas around, it's the northern part of Mesopotamia, if you were to look at your map. Now, there are only two people about whom something special is said in these genealogies, and let's look just briefly at both of them. First, Peleg is mentioned, a descendant of Shem, in verse 25. It says, and two sons were born to Eber. The name of the one was Peleg. For in his days, the earth was divided. Now, it's not clear what it means. Peleg means, in Hebrew, division. So he was born at a time when the earth was divided. What is that division? Some have argued that it is the division that is talked about in chapter 11, the division of peoples spread out over the earth by language. Another speculation is that it is some big earthquake took place, memorable event. And the third thing that is offered is this word Peleg can refer to an irrigation ditch. So Peleg was named for the time when irrigation was first organized and begun. I have no idea which one it is. The only other person about whom there is anything significant said in these genealogies is Nimrod, and that's a little more interesting. Nimrod was a descendant of Ham. His name in Hebrew apparently means, let us rebel. Nimrod means, let us rebel. It says that he was a mighty hunter or a champion. Gibor is the Hebrew word. It shows up a number of times. Sometimes it's used in a very positive sense. You could have a Gibor as a champion of God. And in fact, God is referred to once as a Gibor. But it can also be used in a negative sense. A dictator or a despot. And apparently that's the sense in which it's being used here. It says that he is a mighty hunter. The question is, what does he hunt? I don't think he's a champion elk hunter. From the context, it would appear as though his name means let us rebel. It says that he is a Gibor. And his activities start in the area of Babel. All of those indicate that there's a negative context to what's going on here. So it is probable that he is a mighty hunter in the sense of a man who hunts men. It also says before the Lord. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. And that's a difficult one. It's hard to know what it means before the Lord. Most of the commentaries that I looked at basically punt on this one, and I don't know that I can do any better. But the phrase could even mean against the Lord. And I don't know whether it's being stated that strongly or not. The area, which is his domain, starts out as a group of cities that are collected about Babel, collected in the area of Babel. Then he extends his control to the area around the great city, what is called the great city. And the great city is a term that historically was applied to Nineveh. So whoever this is, he apparently controlled the area around Babel and then extended his control to the area around Nineveh, which later became known as Assyria. Now, how does this accord with known history, history that we know from archaeological finds? According to Babylonian legend, there was a flood. And after the flood, the first kingdom was established in a city called Kish, K-I-S-H, which was near Babel. And it is interesting in this account that the father of Nimrod is Cush. It's possible that there is a relationship between those names. Names in the Old Testament are a little bit tricky. Just because the Bible refers to this fellow as Nimrod does not mean that that was his actual name. I should have looked up examples of this, but I didn't. But I recall from my studies in the past that there are examples of instances where the Bible will call someone by a name that means something in Hebrew that captures the essence of that person, but is kind of a play on the actual name of the person. And I was trying to think of an example of that in modern times and modern politics. And I know that Rush Limbaugh uses such things, but I couldn't dredge any of those up in my memory banks. But I'm sure you know the kind of thing that I'm talking about. Where you just tweak a name, change it a little bit, and so it sounds similar. Everybody knows who you're talking about, but you're saying something about that person, characterizing them or capturing something about them. I wish I could think of an example.
Right.
What? Dan Blather. Great. Great. That will work. What? Al Bohr. There we go. Now it's coming. Just had to get things going. Yes. Better memories than mine. That kind of thing. And that Nimrod could very well be that kind of name. So that if we were to look through the history, the annals of history from ancient times, we may never find a Nimrod, but we might find a name that is similar, that we can identify with it. There is a mythical hero in Sumerian literature called Gilgamesh, and some people have posited that this Nimrod could be associated with Gilgamesh. But we don't know a lot about this Gilgamesh, so it's a little bit hard to know. There is another thing, another name that has been posed as a candidate, and that is Naram-Sin, who was a ruler of Akkad between the years 2230 and 2100 BC. Now, just a little bit of ancient history. Archaeologists tell us, on the basis of their findings, that the oldest civilization in the world, at least this was when I was studying Western Civ, it may have changed since then, but when I was studying Western Civ, it was Sumer. Sumer emerges as a civilization, that is, a city-based society. Sumer emerges as a civilization sometime between 4000 BC and about 3500 BC. 3500 BC is about the time that writing, the oldest writing, appears, and that was in Sumer. Sumer is located, it was located on the Persian Gulf. Now it is considerably inland because the Tigris and Euphrates rivers have carried out so much silt that Sumer has moved away from the coast. But that was where Sumer is located. In modern terms, we're talking about Iraq. Sumer, the archaeologists tell us, was apparently not Semitic. They aren't sure what the origins were, but the language that the Sumerians spoke was not Semitic. Sumer, however, eventually it rose up, was a powerful kingdom, and then it went into decline. It's not clear why it went into decline, but it went into decline, and it was largely an internal problem rather than an external problem. After it declined sufficiently, it was easily conquered by some tribesmen from the hills just to the northeast. Sumer heavily influenced the peoples who were just northwest of them in the Mesopotamian Valley. And those were the Akkadians. The Akkadians were, they absorbed Sumerian culture extensively. I should point out, the Sumerians were a very innovative people. They were the ones who were the first ones to use carts with wheels. They had paved streets, cobblestone streets in their cities. They had sewage systems. They developed, the first to develop writing. They were the first to develop irrigation systems. They had to have irrigation in order to farm the area in which they were living. Those are the first things that come to mind. But they were very innovative. The Akkadians absorbed a lot of that culture, and then they rose to prominence and ended up conquering the area in which the Sumerians lived. And the Akkadians, under Naram-Sin, were able to expand their territory so that it reached from the Persian Gulf, included all of the Mesopotamian Valley, and conquered all the way to the Mediterranean Sea. So under Naram-Sin,
they had an extensive kingdom, one that was unparalleled for the time. So it is suggested that Naram's sin may be this Nimrod. He was called at his time king of the four quarters of the world, and more interestingly, strong male. Great title. Reminds me of alpha male in our time. If it is true that he is to be associated with Naram's sin, that would place Nimrod at about 200 years then before Abraham. Okay. Now, I don't know whether that's a good association or not. I don't know whether that fits well. It may be that Nimrod is not just one person. Seems to me that it's possible that it could be more flexible than that. In any case, it is a descendant of Ham who was the first builder of empire. So if I'm understanding what's happening in Genesis correctly, after the flood, God is kind of stepping into the background. He's not going to be so hands-on in the affairs of man. He authorizes and is going to allow now the developments of government. But man is still at heart the same man that he was before the flood. Man was not changed by the flood. And as a result, we begin to have states that are despotic, ambitious, aggressive. And this state that was established by Nimrod is the first one of these particularly aggressive and despotic states to come into being. That then sets us up for what it talks about in chapter 11 of Genesis. Let's read through this, the first 9 verses. Now the whole earth used the same language and the same words. And it came about as they journeyed east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar. Shinar is Sumer. And settled there. And they said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly." And they used brick for stone, and they used tar for mortar. And they said, "Come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven. And let us make for ourselves a name, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth." And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, "Behold, they are one people, and they all have the same language. And this is what they began to do. And now nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and there confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech." So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. Therefore its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the whole earth. Okay, it's not clear when this is happening. Apparently, having just recorded the genealogies of how the sons of Noah and their descendants had spread across the earth, the author has decided to account for the fact that all of these people, descendant from one couple, have developed different languages and have developed into different peoples. It starts out by saying the whole earth used the same language and the same words. If we take this all the whole earth to mean the whole earth, and that is, it's possible that it means the whole land, talking about a specific area. But I'm inclined to think that this is probably talking about the whole earth in the sense of the bulk of the population at the time this occurred. So I'm inclined to think that this is an event that happened early on in the genealogies that are listed in the previous chapter. That this was a relatively early event after the flood. It happens in the plain of Sumer, which, as I mentioned, is the first place that becomes civilized. Now, if you take the account of the archaeologists as they're describing the development of civilization, the peoples, the most advanced peoples of the earth, are those that develop along this ridge of highlands that comes down from near the Caucasus, which is interesting, because Mount Ararat is located in the Caucasus. It progresses down the highlands just to the east of the Mesopotamian Valley. And as they move south, these cultures become more and more advanced, and they develop agriculture to a greater and greater extent. And at some point, they decided to move down onto the plain. The problem with moving down onto the plain, though, it was very good soil, but the problem was getting water to the soil. There are rivers that flow through the area, but the rainfall is very erratic. And the flooding is unpredictable and oftentimes catastrophic. Unlike the Nile, Egypt was very blessed in its conditions because the Nile River would flood at the same time every year. In fact, the priests of Egypt set the date when the flooding would occur each year. They would tell the people the flooding will occur next week. And the waters would gently rise starting on that day. And it would flood the land, and then the flood would recede at about the same time every year. And the Egyptians could count on that. So agriculture was relatively easy in Egypt. In Mesopotamia, the land is very good, but the flooding is erratic and oftentimes catastrophic. So it makes it very different. And in order to get the water to the crops on the good land, they had to develop a system of irrigation. So by moving from the highlands down on the plains, they had to live differently. They had to be more organized and work together in order for it to be possible. So that was an important move when they moved from the highlands down onto the plains in Mesopotamia. And the story here matches that. It says, they said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly." And they used brick for stone, and they used tar for mortar. It is true that the first baked bricks that have been found by archaeologists occur in Mesopotamia. They were the ones who first began they learned how to bake first pottery, and then they learned to bake bricks. By baking the bricks, they could build buildings that were much more durable, much more long-lasting, and stronger. And there is a great deal of tar in that area, which you may guess, because there's also a great deal of oil. And they began to use tar as mortar between their bricks. And that has archaeologically been found to be true. So apparently in this story, what is happening is they're saying, we have made some innovations which are great breakthroughs. Let us use our technological innovations to strengthen this society. What they've discovered is there's an amazing amount of potential behind manpower. If we can get enough people working together on the same project, it is amazing what we will be able to accomplish. So it's that first taste of the potential of mankind. That's what they're sensing. But in order to make use of that, you have to have intense social organization, very good social organization, so everybody's working together, and a large population, a lot of people. So they've got this problem. How do we keep all of these people here working together? And their solution? Let's use our technology to bring about civic cohesion. What they decide to do is build a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven. And by doing that, they hope to accomplish two things. One is bring fame, make a name for themselves. And the second is keep themselves from scattering over the face of the earth. Okay. So apparently what they're trying to do, they're thinking. And if the archaeologists are correct, this is a people that has been in the highlands. And now they've moved on to the plain. And the In-Sumer, they believed that you could make contact with God best. Your access to God was best on mountaintops. The only problem with Mesopotamia was there were none. It's flat land. It's just a plain. So their solution is, let's use our technological abilities and our ability to organize together, and let's build our own mountain so that our people can have access to God. That's one way to keep them here. Who doesn't want ready access to God? So they built this mountain, and historically, ziggurats, you've probably seen pictures of them, ziggurats dotted the landscape of ancient Mesopotamia. They were similar to the pyramids, large structures, stair-step structures, with a temple at the very top. And it was thought that that is where the gods resided and could be contacted. So by building this city and this tower that reaches, its top reaches into heaven, they can provide their people with two things, civic pride and access to God. And that if we can do those two things, we can keep people here and we can keep people working on this same project, that is, building up our state. God responds to this. God's response is first to come down to see what has happened. It's interesting, obviously, God knows what's happening. But in the account, what this points out is God does not act rashly. God is taking everything into consideration, making sure that he knows the facts before he acts. He comes down to see what they have done, and this mortal man has had the audacity to create his own way of his own access to God, his own way to control and use God for his purposes. God looks at the situation. He says, they are one people with one language. They are unified. and nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them. I think what he's acknowledging is, if mankind works together, his potential is truly amazing. Truly amazing. But God looks at that and he says, I cannot allow them to succeed. Because if they exceed, their arrogance will be only greater, and the destruction that they will bring through their wickedness will be unthinkable, unspeakable. So in response to their let us build, God says, let us confuse their speech, their language. So God apparently comes down, acts in a way, and I don't know how he does this, but he acts in such a way that they cannot communicate one to the other. He makes it impossible for this unity to persist. He frustrates this unity. And he scatters them over the face of the earth. What is striking about this story is that man, in his arrogance and in his independence and rebelliousness against God, his attempt to take matters into his own hand, to control his existence as much as possible. In his attempt to do that, he set out to do three things. There are three things that the people of Babel tried to accomplish. They wanted to build a city with a tower reaching into the sky. They wanted to make a name for themselves. And they wanted to keep from being spread over the face of the earth. God looked at man's rebelliousness and arrogance and said, I cannot allow that to happen. I cannot allow them to persist in that kind of arrogance and be successful in that kind of arrogance, or even think that they are successful in that kind of arrogance. So he entered into this situation in such a way that none of the three things that they set out to do happened. They stopped building the city. They became famous only in the sense that they became infamous. And they were spread over the face of the earth. That God used failure to point out to man that apart from him, there is no success. There can be no success. And God doesn't even want the illusion of success to be there. The word Babel, if you'll note in your, probably in your margin, means to confuse. So God confused the languages and then spread them over the earth. Okay. If I'm understanding this correctly, then, the story of Nimrod and the story of Babel both fit together very well in that they are describing a problem that develops early after the flood, relatively early after the flood. That before the flood, God was more directly and personally involved in the lives of people on earth. But after the flood, God decides to step back more into the background and be less overt in his interaction with mankind. And in order for him to step back, there has to be some curb on wickedness. And the curb that he places on wickedness is granting the authority to governments to punish outrageous wickedness on their own. So man will do that through the instrument of the state. But the problem is, man was not changed by the flood. man is still the wicked creature that he was before the flood, rebellious. As a result, then, God steps in here, and when the people of Babel try to build up this kingdom, unite and use technology to control their environment and become their own gods, God says, I will not allow that to succeed. That will not happen. And he steps in such a way that Babel, at this time, does not happen. Now, it seems to me that the history of Western civilization is a story, a long story of attempts to recreate Babel. It's a whole series of attempts to try to build empire. Because we all understand that there is an enormous amount of power that can be generated by people working together. An awful lot can be done. And it's an enormous powerhouse, enormous resource. And so people have tried to build empire ever since Babel. But in various ways, God has entered in and frustrated those attempts. Various empires have come into being, but they have all, for one reason or another, collapsed over time. However, the attempts have become better and better and better over time. If you look at the Greeks, they make certain steps in that direction. The Romans make even greater steps in that direction. And we get into more modern times, Napoleon made steps in that direction. Hitler made steps in that direction. That attempt to reach out and bring in millions of people and bring them into one enterprise. Various people have tried that at various times, and we're getting better and better at it. If you think about the power of bringing all these people together, think about modern times. To a large extent, modern times are an example of that. And think of some of the strides that have been made with respect to, for instance, gene splicing. That is truly phenomenal. It's astounding. And if you were to tell people that lived 100 years ago about gene splicing, they would probably describe it as miraculous. We put a man on the moon. Truly astounding. And then the advent of computers and how they are improving, and the developments year by year are, I'm sure to all of us, frustrating. You buy a computer and 2 weeks later it's out of date and you can't get software for it. But the progress is so fast, it's mind-boggling, and in fact, it's almost a full-time job to keep up. How is that possible? Well, it's possible because a lot of people are working on it. There's a sense in which in modern times, through modernization, what we call modernization, and now globalization, there's a sense in which we've taken this concept of empire and extended it in a way that the ancients never could have dreamed of. And so it is now to the point where, to a large extent, we have people all over the world working on some of the same projects and making enormous strides in those areas. And how that's been done is a longer story, but it is truly fascinating how the developments that came about largely in Western civilization have laid the groundwork for shaping our minds as to how we think about the world, and also shaping society and our economic system such that everything is pushing in the same direction worldwide in a way that's never happened before. I find that particularly interesting in light of the fact that in the prophecy of the Bible, it talks about the Babylon that will exist in the end times. But this Babylon will reach a higher degree of success than any of the previous Babylons. And I think that it's highly likely that the Babylon that it's talking about in prophecy is this. It's not so much a place as it is a concept. It's the concept of all working together using baked bricks to build a tower that reaches into heaven. The new Babylon will also fail. It is doomed to destruction. That ultimately, we do not hold in our hands our own salvation. Salvation only comes by God. And it's only by our repentance and turning to Him that there is a solution to our problem, that problem of being alienated and rebellious against God. And God will not allow even the new Babylon to enjoy real success. There will only be the semblance of success. God typically uses our failures as a way of awakening us to the realities of life and to getting us to stare reality into the face sometimes for the first time. Okay, any questions or comments? Well, why don't you wait for the mic so that everybody can hear you?
You said that Babylon, Babel means failure or something. What does Babylon mean?
Babel, the Hebrew name for Babylon, means to confuse. Babylon we get from the Greek, and it comes from the word the gate of God. That's what the Babylonians called Babel, was the gate of God. And then that was then transliterated into Greek, and that's where we get our English term Babylon. And it's interesting that it was called the Gate of God. Their temples were called, let me see if I've got in my notes, their ziggurats. I don't have it in my notes, but one of the main ziggurats in Babylon was called, I think, the entrance way to heaven or something like that. Yes?
I wonder if the Babel, the confusion, isn't the scattering. That's how God confused the language. Because it seems in this context that could very well be.
Yeah. So what you mean is he confused their languages by scattering them and allowing different languages then to develop because they're isolated one from another. That's a good thought. I think that's possible. Rather than in some kind of
kind of weird way entering into people's minds so that they, I mean, the image you always get in as a child is someone says, give me a brick, and the other person, that makes no sense to them, and so they stop building. But I suppose if we look at the affairs of mankind, there was probably a falling out between two factions within the city, and they end up going their separate ways. That would be more typical for our experience. That could very well be. That's a good thought.
Could you unpack the let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered? How does that work?
How does making a name for themselves keep them from being scattered? On some of the inscriptions of the ancient buildings of Nineveh and Babylon, it explicitly says that, for instance, Nebuchadnezzar built a temple, and an inscription said, to preserve an eternal memory of my power and strength. So that was something that they did. Now, how would that bring about cohesion? Well, by analogy, let me use the Roman Empire. The Romans took in a wide variety of peoples, and they, better than any other of the ancient empires, were able to make them a cohesive unit. And one of the ways they did that is every place they went, they built cities. And they were Roman cities with all of the conveniences that you would expect of a Roman city, including abundant water. So they would build cities where before there had been nothing but desert, and it would be well supplied with water, because they had the ability to make the aqueducts, which would carry the water for long distances. By doing that, they established that they were the dominant culture of the world. And where they would build these cities, people in the surrounding area would see them, and they would be so amazed at what the Romans could accomplish that they all wanted to be identified with Roman culture. So many of them Romanized. I suspect that they wanted a similar thing in Babel. They're trying to bring about a pride of being Babylonian, such that you wouldn't think of going elsewhere, and you wouldn't think of not cooperating with the project of Babylon. So I think that that's what it's talking about. It's talking about bringing about a kind of civic pride that is so great that that keeps people together. You see, the problem with building empire is, how do you keep these people together, not just physically, but mentally? You can keep a lot of people together by force. There are two problems with that. One is it takes a lot of force to do it. And the second is you've got dispirited people. A good empire has a lot of people who for some reason want to be there. Then you've got a really productive machine. And so I think what it's talking about here is that building that kind of civic pride that keeps them there, and they want to be there. They all want to be united in this project.
This question certainly reflects my not liking something, mm-hmm. and it may be one of the questions that can't be answered, but I'm way back to the beginning of your talk when you spoke of the flood, and our hearts were really evil before the flood, and so God destroyed almost everybody. Mm-hmm. But after the flood, your comment was, and of course this is true, our hearts were the same. So it doesn't make any sense to me that God would wipe out all of us just to have the same problem occur again, mm-hmm. so that we can get wiped out again.
Mm-hmm. And why did God do it that way? Is that your question?
Why in the world? Yeah.
As you guessed, I don't know. God does a lot of mysterious things. But he did accomplish something there that is important, I think. And that is, he really disabused us of the notion that all we need is to understand the consequences of what we're doing. That the threat of punishment will not tame the evil that's within us. And this was severe punishment. And I think it foreshadows, it also indicates that God is not afraid to punish wholesale mankind in judgment for his sin. So I think it's kind of foreshadowing as well as making it clear that the threat of punishment is not enough. The nature of the evil within us is too great to be solved by the threat of punishment. It's a much deeper kind of rebelliousness that's in us. Could he have done it another way? I don't know. Chris?
In verse 7, who is the us that it's talking about? Come, let us go down there and mm-hmm. confuse their language. Mm-hmm. And what does it mean to go down there? Mm-hmm. Did God become physical or?
What does it mean when he says go down there? I think it's just meaning I am going to look at the situation here. And I think that's even speaking anthropomorphically, that God already knew, but in the account, it wants to portray God as taking a serious interest in knowing exactly what's going on here. So I think that's why it has that wording. Why us? We've seen this before. Let us make man in our own image. That seems to be a term of deliberation that God uses, that's used by the biblical author sometimes with respect to God. It also fits very nicely in response to what the people of Babel had said. The people of Babel had said, let us do one thing, and God says, let us do another thing. So I think part of it is making that connection, and part of it is God, that's not atypical for God to be described as deliberating with himself as to what he will do by saying, let us do X.
I was just thinking, kind of tagging on what Christine was saying, that it's also a picture, I mean, it is a picture of God punishing, but it's also a great picture of God providing salvation.
Yes.
And delineating between his salvation for a righteous man and his punishment of wickedness.
Yes.
But
yes.
He did save Noah.
Yes. So. There are a lot of parallels between the judgment of the flood and the ultimate judgment. That's very true. Let's go here and then we'll go over here.
I was wondering what the purpose of genealogies are in the Bible. Why do authors include them? What do they work towards in their goal?
I'd have to think about that some. There are various purposes that are being served. One of them is just showing the continuity. The Bible is laying out a continuous line from Adam all the way down to the Israelites and even even through Israelite history right down to Jesus. So we've got this line of continuity that's been retained by the Bible. And I think it helps us to see that we all fit into, in particular chapter 10, we all fit into this someplace. We are a unified whole. All of mankind is related. We are all the same stuff. And we all have our place in that vast array of mankind that God has brought into being. But other than that, I'd have to think about it. One of the catastrophes of modern culture is it has deprived us of a sense of place. And historically, people have found their sense of place by their genealogy. Where did their family, where did I fit in? Who is my father? Who is their father's father? If you look at, I know a little bit about, for instance, Ethiopian culture. My niece married an Ethiopian, and as part of their education, they are required to memorize their genealogy back 30 generations. There's something about that gives you a sense of, I know who I am, and I know how I fit into this world in a way that we have kind of stripped away. If I ask you who you are in modern times, what do you say? It's your profession. In ancient times, it's I'm the son of. And there's something more permanent, there's something more satisfying about the answer I'm the son of than today I am a plumber. Because I don't know if I will be tomorrow. It depends how the economy changes. There's just something more satisfying about that. And I think that's part of the impetus behind the genealogies. But other than that, I'd have to think about it more. We've got way over here.
David, any speculation on where the other peoples came from, Asians and Africans? And in terms of just the growth of the population, in terms of, can you kind of comment about that too?
I would assume that if we had enough information, all the Asians, the other Africans, that they would all be come back to these roots, that they're just combinations of intermarriages between the various peoples that are described here. Obviously, to lay out the genealogy in all of its detail would be a very complex thing, because in many areas we've got peoples overlapping and intermarrying. We have peoples who adopt the language that is not the language of their ancestors, adopting cultures that are not their cultures. So now, for instance, I don't need to go into all the examples, but it would be enormously complex. My assumption is that all of the peoples in the world now ultimately trace their roots back to these descendants of Japheth, Ham, and Shem. And I would assume that the Asians are a combination of descendants of Japheth and probably descendants of Shem. And the other Africans are probably largely descendants of Ham. linguists and anthropologists would know, would better be able to answer that. It is interesting that anthropologists, for the most part, assume, they think that it is demonstrable that we all descend from one couple. We're all related. There had been theories of human beings popping up at different places at different times that anthropologists entertained for a while, but I don't know that any anthropologists hold to that any longer. Okay, well, there was one more. Margaret.
Two questions. It's striking to me how much Pentecost is the undoing of Babel. Mm-hmm. That when the Holy Spirit shows up, the most striking manifestation, apart from the tongues of flame, are that people start talking in all those different languages that God originally gave them, or they were the agent of confusion, and now.
Yes.
God reaches out through all those languages to bring everybody together.
That's very interesting.
Another question. This past week has been a really difficult week because as a lot of you know, because I talk about her frequently, my most the person I work with closest is a radical lesbian feminist. But she and I have become really good friends and talk about things and fight about things with great abandon. And mm-hmm. It's actually a very rewarding relationship. But it's also hard on both of us because we're both coming from a different place.
Yeah.
And we were talking about Measure 9 last week. And it was really disturbing because I realized that there's a part of me that wants to simplify the whole issue in terms of, look, I don't care how civilized and how kind and how whatever a gay or lesbian couple is. The fact of the matter is that it's a insult against God. It is utterly contrary to the way to his design for sexuality. And so if they are good citizens, you know, that's great, and I'm glad they are good citizens and they love their children and that kind of thing. But when it comes down to it, the bottom line is this is really flipping God off as far as I can see. But then as I'm talking with my colleague, she's pointing out, you know, how are teachers going to stop kids from beating up gay kids, assuming that there are such things. But she says, if Measure 9 passes, they will not be able to say, you need to respect this person, you can't beat them up. And I'm saying, well, why do they have to say, you need to respect them? Can't you say, I don't care if this person is an axe murderer, it's not your job to beat them up? And she said she wanted to know what my objection was to saying, she said, I don't agree with everything that you say, but I say that you should be respected. You know, shouldn't I be respected too? And I was just, you know, my brain's going around in circles because on one sense, yes, respect in the sense of love, concern for the well-being of. On the other hand, am I going to say, whatever you're doing is fine with me? That kind of respect? No. Respect is a really kind of ambiguous term. Mm-hmm. And so I'm trying to make sense of, given that the main deal here, it all has to do with how you relate to God. Because in terms of how her sexual orientation or practices affect me, directly, no. She's a good citizen. She's kind to me. She helps me out. I wouldn't want her to leave. But on the other hand, her lifestyle is an insult to God. That matters to me even more. So I'm thinking, I'm a citizen of this country. and I'm trying to make decisions about the laws. In this country, I used to think of as a Christian country, at least it started out that way, and it used to be that I didn't have to worry about, I wouldn't have had, you know, 200 years ago, to worry about laws which would be an insult to God, for the most part. But now I do. And so now I'm thinking that somehow in the past 200 years, our country has evolved from being a city of God, I guess, to a Babylon. I'm a stranger in this country in the same way the Jews were strangers in Babylon. And my job, since it doesn't look like this is going to change quickly, is to do the same thing that God commanded the Jews to do when they were sent to Babylon, which is make homes there, you know, marry off your sons and daughters, work for the well-being of the country. But at the same time, we really are strangers in a strange land. Is this an accident?
No, and this comes back to your first comment, which is I hadn't made that association between Pentecost and Babel. That's a very good one. I think that's very interesting. There's a sense in which having the same language brings about a semblance of unity where in fact there is none. Because if you take all of the residents of Babel, what is their primary goal in life? Probably, if it's like the average American, it's to get through life as comfortably and painlessly as possible. And that may mean that someone else will have to suffer pain. That's okay. So there's a sense in which they're working at cross purposes. They think they're working towards the same thing, but in fact, they're working towards, like in America, what, 250 million different goals. And the fact that they all speak the same language brings about the semblance of unity, where in fact there isn't a unity of purpose. The only time you have unity of purpose is when we're freed from our own individual goal and we're all redirected towards the goal for which we were intended right from the beginning. So there can only be true unity in the ultimate sense, between believers. And we should feel like strangers here. We are strangers here. And it's not just in America. We would be strangers in any country. We are just passing through. And I think you're right. We need to live here, make our homes here. We're a part of this thing. We need to wish America well, but we ought not confuse the fact that ultimately we are made of different stuff. We have a different goal than the American dream, and not allow ourselves to be sucked up into that other perspective on life, which is so seductive. It really is. I mean, it's that perspective on life that has won over the world, I think, and has set up the Babylon to come. Okay, we need to quit. Thanks.